This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Firstly, welcome back from the holiday break that we had, and I hope that we can look forward to a year of further learning together. Last night we learned the Rashi at the end of Perek Mem Tes, where Yaakov says to Yosef, Birchos Avicha Govru al Birchos Horai. The brachos of your father, that's Yaakov, are more powerful than the brachos of my parents, Avram and Yitzchak. Because, says Rashi, Lefi shehabrachos sheli Govru ad soif gvulei givos oilom. For the brachos that were given to me are powerful right till the ends of the hills of the world. Shenosan li brocho prutzo b'li meitzorim. For the Ribbono Shel Olam gave me a brocho wide open without barriers. Magas ad dalet kitzveis ha'ilom, which reach until the four ends of the earth. Shenemar, as it says, uforatzto yamo v'kedmo tzafoino v'negba. Mashaloi omar l'Avrom Avinu uli Yitzchak, which he did not do to Avrom and Yitzchak. Avrom and Yitzchak were each given brochas with limitations. Yaakov was given an unlimited brocha of uforatzto yamo v'kedma tzofeinu v'negbo, you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. And we began to understand this Chazal last night by trying to analyze in what way did Yaakov merit this limitless brocha more than Avrom and Yitzchak. And we said that Avrom's contribution to the development of our civilization was in many areas, but particularly in the area of chesed, of kindness. And we discussed last night how kindness needs boundaries. Kindness needs borders. Unlimited chesed, undisciplined kindness, is destructive in the extreme. When one is unable to be cruel, when one is unable to do anything but be kind, and one can only say yes, the result is destruction. Sometimes one destroys oneself, sometimes one destroys others, sometimes one destroys both. We see parents who've destroyed children by not being able to limit their chesed, limit their kindness. We see people who've destroyed themselves by not being able to limit their kindness to themselves. Chesed needs a gvul. Chesed needs a border. It cannot be unlimited. And likewise, the contribution of Yitzchak to our civilization, that of gvuro. Gvuro is discipline. Gvuro is that power that we've been talking about. That also needs to be barriered and contained. There are times when one has to be cruel. One has to be cruel to oneself. One has to be cruel to others. A surgeon sometimes has to take a knife and he has to rip a person open. It's cruel, but it's kind. But achzarius, which is unbridled, cruelty which is unlimited, which knows no limits, becomes barbarism. There's no container for it. And so as great as chesed is, it needs to be contained. And as vital as Gevura is sometimes, it also needs to be contained. But there's a point which is equidistant from both extremities of Chesed and of Gevura. We discussed last night that Chesed is usually the interests of others. Gevura is my interests. And there's a point which is equidistant from both extremes. And that's the point of emes, the point of truth. If one tends towards one extreme or the other, one's off that line of emes. Emes is where one is equidistant from both the extremities of chesed and the extremities of gevura, both the extremities of kindness and the extremities of power and discipline. Certain nations one finds are extreme in chesed. They don't know how to limit it. Other nations are extreme in gevura. Am Yisrael is meant to find that middle point, to be able to be equidistant from chesed and from gevura. And emes was the middle of Yaakov. That's what Yaakov stood for more than anything else. Emes. And therefore Yaakov gets the brocha b'li meitzorim. Because an extreme, by its definition, has an end. The extreme is the point closest to the end. Emes doesn't tend towards either extreme, and therefore it has no gevul. You can imagine a lateral line has two extremes on either end, but if one is able to take a midpoint between them and to follow a line which remains equidistant from both extremes, then you'll never reach the end. As long as you're veering to one end or the other, you'll eventually reach the end. But if one can maintain a course which remains equidistant of both extremities at all times, one will never reach the end. And that's the middle of emes of Yaakov. The Maharal refers to Yaakov's middle as yoshor, also as straight. And Yaakov is called in several places Yeshurun. Yeshurun is a name which we took after that from Bnei Yisrael. Took that. Yisrael also has that root, Yud Shin Reish, which is Yosha. It was only at the time of Yaakov that the name Yisrael was given, that the name Yeshurun was given, where there's that straightness. Because if one's straight, one doesn't veer to either extreme. The moment one ceases to be straight, one's veering to an extreme. And if one's veering to an extreme, there are boundaries. If one is down that middle line, there are no boundaries. The root of emes and the root of yashrus knows no extremities. Doesn't know such a thing. In the world of emes, there are no extremes. It's in fact one of the malices of the world in which we live that we are governed so by extremes in every area that to find balance is difficult. And even the balanced person is always looking over his shoulder to see what the extremes are going to be saying about him, how he fits in with the extremes. We're constantly judging ourselves in relationship to the extremities. If we judge ourselves in relationship to the extremities, then we're involved in limited things and things that have limitations. If we're unaware of the extremities, if they don't exist, then we're involved in something which is universal and something which is eternal and something which knows no limits and knows no extremes. In the Torah world too, this is a problem. Emes requires straightness of mind. It requires straightness of character. It requires enormous effort, intellectual effort, depth, integrity, And that's hard. It's easier to be extreme. And if one's extreme, then one is able to feel all the symptoms of being right. Right in the sense of correct. Without necessarily being right. If I measure my level by how far to the right it is of somebody else's level, then we must veer towards more and more extreme. There's no end to it. And for an individual to say, I couldn't care where I am vis-a-vis anybody else, and I couldn't care where I am vis-a-vis the right or the left of anybody else, all I'm interested in knowing is that what I'm doing or what I'm saying is emes. For that one needs great strength of character. And that strength of character is not encouraged in our society today. It's hard. Yosher, there's another element to Yosher, to that straightness that we're talking about. That is that if something, again, let's picture our lateral line with the two extremes, the left and the right, on either side, and the vertical line in the middle, always remaining equidistant from the two extremes. The moment that vertical line tends to either left or right, it is being affected by the extreme. It's not just that it tends towards the extreme, but it's gravitating towards the extreme. It's unable to resist the gravitational pull of the extremes. But that's what it is. There's such a thing as polarization, and when there's a powerful pole at both ends, both extremes pull on an individual. And some people try to retain a balance by keeping both extremes in their eyes and try to walk down the middle. And other people aren't interested in the balance. They want to be at the extremes or move towards the extremes. And they find themselves moving laterally rather than vertically. They find themselves looking left and right. They're not looking up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. They're not judging themselves vis-a-vis the Ribbono Shel Olam. They're just looking who's on their left and who's on their right. And anybody who's on their left is a reformed Jew, and anybody who's on their right is a fanatic. And that's the way they define the center line. And if they want to become a little bit more religious, they just take another step to the right. It's as easy as that. You don't have to become better. You don't have to become more honest. You don't have to become greater. You just have to move a little bit to the right to become a little bit more frum. And so the movement is always lateral. Whereas the person who's working on the basis of emes is not interested where he is on the lateral line. What he's interested in is that where he is on the vertical line. And that's all that he looks at. Where has he gone in relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam? Has he become more godly or less godly? That's all he's interested in. And the moment he finds himself making decisions which tend towards either extreme, then he's lost his yashrus. Then he's lost his straightness. When he says something or does something to placate the right or to placate the left, the straightness is gone. The element of yashrus and of emes is that independence of the extremities. As long as I'm on the vertical line, the ultimate is unlimited. It's God. The Ribbono Shel Olam's up there. How far can I go? Unlimited. If I'm moving on the horizontal line, how far can I go? I can see who's the frumest person on the right. That's how far I can go. I can't go further than that. That's as far as the line goes. When you're working laterally, you're working with limitations and with boundaries. When you're working vertically, there are no limitations and there are no boundaries. Works like that in Metzius as well. If I have a piece of property, how far can I walk to the left or to the right before I hit the boundary? It's very clearly defined. So and so many meters to the left and so many meters to the right. But up or down, unlimited. There's no boundary there. Not a artificial boundaries, they want to make artificial legal boundaries, and do what they want. But Lamaisa, I can go as high as I want, and I can drop as low as I want. If I'm working vertically, I'm not governed by the lateral barriers that limit people's movements in the yoyla. And Yaakov was not governed by lateral barriers. It wasn't Yaakov. Yaakov didn't work on the lateral. Yaakov worked on the vertical. And therefore he's given a brocha, prutzo bli metzorim. A brocha wide open without limitations. But there's another element of Yaakov. Well, let us say there's another element where this principle applies, the absence of limitations. And that's in the area of Kedusha. In the material world, there are limitations. That is, the nature of matter is to be limited. It is quantified and quantifiable. All material things are quantified and quantifiable. Spiritual things, by their definition, are not quantifiable and are not quantified. There is no limitation. Spiritual thing doesn't have a measure. It doesn't have dimensions. One cannot relate to it in any form, in any quantitative form at all. It's only qualitative. And therefore, when one comes into the world of Kedusha, one again abandons all areas of limitations, of measures, of boundaries. There are no boundaries in the Olam of Ruchnius, there are no boundaries. And that's why, as destructive as kino, as destructive as jealousy is in the material world, when people become jealous of each other, it's totally destructive. In the spiritual world, we say kina seifim tarbe chokhma. It's healthy, it's good, because there are no boundaries. Jealousy is only damaging if I'm jealous of something you've got, and by definition it belongs to you, it's in your boundary. I can't get it without stealing it. But in the spiritual world where there are no boundaries, if I'm jealous of what you've got, that's a wonderful thing. I'll take some too. There's plenty more where it came from. There are no limitations. And when you're dealing with the absence of limitations, you're dealing with a situation where jealousy can be nothing but positive. Where there's no insecurity, where there's no threat, where an individual lives on a completely different plane. That's Kedusha. It's interesting though that to achieve Kedusha, one needs to create a boundary. We say Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'chol. That's what Havdalah is. Ben Yom HaShvi'i l'Sheshesh Yomei HaMaaseh. Havdalah, to discern, to draw a boundary line between Kodesh and Chol, between holy and secular, between Shabbos and weekdays. We make this clear distinction. How does that work? If we've just said that Kedusha, like Emes and like Yosher, has no limitation and has no boundaries, but it does have boundaries. Shabbos comes to an end, Shabbos has a beginning, there's a boundary line. Kedusha is perishus. Kedusha, we've learned, means a withdrawal from the material secular world. That's what Kedusha means. So that's a boundary. They say that somewhere between Johannesburg and Sun City there's a boundary. Nobody tells me that they've actually seen it, but they say that there is such a thing. There's Kodesh and Chol. There's going to be a place where there's got to be a boundary line somewhere. So how can we say that Kodesh is unlimited? If secular is unlimited, it hits the boundary line, Kodesh also hits the boundary line. The answer is that boundary line between Kodesh and Chol is a vertical boundary line, not a lateral boundary line. Imagine, for example, a transparency that you can place over a text. So you can have a drawing or whatever, and you can put a transparency over that. And through the transparency you can see everything underneath it. The transparency is completely separate from the drawing underneath. You can remove it. You can destroy the one without destroying the other. So is it separate? Yes, it's separate. But yet laterally you won't notice. If it's a good transparency, you won't notice it at all. It's superimposed. Separate but superimposed. So that laterally there are no dividing lines. But vertically there are. It can be removed.
And so the dividing line which sanctity requires of us is a vertical dividing line. It doesn't mean that there's a part of life which we must cut ourselves off from. It's not a question of taking life and saying that section of life, that we must have nothing to do with. It's profane. That's where Yiddishkeit differs from all other religions. Our boundary line is vertical. We have to superimpose ourselves over the entire spectrum of life. There's nothing in life which doesn't fall within the ambit of Torah. But we're the transparency. We're superimposed over the world. And that's how we come in touch with the whole world, not a part of it. We're separate of it, from it, and yet we're close to it at all times. That's the peculiar subtlety of Kedusha. But at one and the same time, we're close and a part of it, and yet we're separate from it. Well, to take that concept a little further, we affect the world around us. We are not affected by the world around us. That's Kedusha. When a person finds himself affected by his environment, he's not involved in Kedusha. When he affects his environment and is not affected by it, that's when he's involved in Kedusha. And that's back to our transparency. You can make all sorts of drawings on the transparency and superimpose them on the bottom drawing. So the transparency affects what you're now looking at. But at any time you can remove the transparency and the transparency remains untouched. It's there, it affects every part of the bottom drawing. But it's separate. It stands on its own. What appears on the transparency is not a reflection of what's underneath it. What appears on the transparency is what we've put on the transparency and we have superimposed it upon the bottom drawing in order to create a whole new impression altogether. And so it is with Kedusha. We have to relate to every part of life and to every part of the universe. There's nothing in the world and there's nothing in life which is of no interest to us. Our curiosity has to extend to every corner of the world and to every corner of life. But we're not to be affected by it. We're there only to affect, but not to be affected. We're there to be the subject of our relationship with the world around us, not to be the object of our relationship with the world around us. And Kedusha also knows no limitations. When we're operating in the world of Kedusha, when we've elevated ourselves just one degree up vertically, laterally it's all the same. A man who's a Kodesh sees the same world as an ordinary person. He also goes to the market, and he also catches a bus, and he also goes to work, and he also comes home and lives a normal family life. Yet he's a Kodesh, superimposed. His life looks different, because he affects the world around him differently. He sees it differently, and he's not affected by it. His moods are not affected by the world around him. His attitudes are not affected by the world around him. His mind is not affected by the world around him. In that area, he's independent. And Yaakov, part of Yaakov's middah was Kedusha as well. In the beginning of the Shmoneh Esrei, we have three important brachas. The first one is Mogen Avrom. That bracha was instituted by Avrom Avinu. The second bracha is Machaye HaMesim, revival of the dead. That bracha was said by Yitzchok when he survived the close shave that he had with the Mizbeach. When he was nearly brought as a sacrifice and he came out of it alive, he instituted the second bracha of the Shmoneh Esrei, Mechaye HaMesim. And the third bracha is Hokel HaKodosh, Ato Kodosh, Shimcha Kodosh. The third bracha is called Kedusha. It's the bracha of sanctity, and that bracha was instituted by Yaakov. And so again we see that that midah of limitlessness, that midah of spirituality, is the peculiar midah of Yaakov. That's what he gave to the world. So we get some idea why it is that Yaakov is chosen as the one to get the limitless bracha, because Yaakov's whole area of Avodas Hashem was in the area of breaking down the barriers of the material world. A material object is affected. If you take a piece of wood and you take an axe and you hack the piece of wood breaks. That's the nature of matter. To every action there is a reaction. That's a law of physics. That's not a law of spirituality. That's not a law of ruchnis. It's a law of gashmis. A spiritual thing, you can't affect that easily. You can take an axe and you can hack a person to pieces. His body will go. The neshama is untouched. Absolutely untouched. And we learned the Gemara. The Gemara says in Shabbos Daf Kuf Yud Ches Kol Ame'ane Ges HaShabbos Noisnim Lo Yinachal Lo Bli Meitzorim. But if a person enjoys his Shabbos properly, he too gets an unlimited bracha. And we discussed how on Shabbos we have the capability of experiencing some of this limitlessness. Last night we discussed, we abandon our businesses, we abandon all thoughts of material things and our incomes and money and all the rest of it. So we break down the physical barriers. And once you've broken down the physical barriers, one is left with oinig. One is left with enjoyment and with pleasure. But let's take that thought a little bit further. The word used here for barriers and for limitations is the word metzorim. Meitzorim comes from the word tsar, which means boundary, it means narrow, and it also means tsoros. The Maharal says that a spiritual person can't suffer tsoros, because tsoros can only be suffered by a person who is affected by his environment. But if you're not affected by your environment, what kind of tsoros can you suffer? Doesn't mean that there are no tsoros. The tsoros don't affect me. Tsoros don't affect a spiritual being. They only affect a physical being, because nothing affects a spiritual being. He's not affected. Only he affects himself. You might remember towards the end of last year, we had such a concept which we touched on, and I said we would come back to in the Kuzari, I think it was, a concept of that the neshama, the soul, is peculiar in that it can work on itself. Sorry? It was in the Sefer HaYoshev Rabbeinu Tam. Thank you, Stan. It was in the Sefer HaYoshev Rabbeinu Tam. That whereas normally a subject and an object have to be two different beings. A carpenter can't turn himself into a table, he needs to turn a piece of wood into a table. And a piece of wood can't turn itself into a table, it needs a carpenter. You need always the gavra and the chefta. You need a subject and an object. When it comes to the neshama, you can be the subject and the object in one. You can affect your own neshama. You can affect your own being, your own spirituality. But others can't affect it so easily. Only you can affect it. You are the Yotzer. You are the creator of your own soul, in a sense. You are a shutuf. You're a partner with the Ribbono Shel Olam in the creation of your own soul. And you can develop it. And you can nurture it. And you can take it further. And you can deepen it. Nobody else can do that. And you can destroy it. Nobody else can destroy it. Only we can do that ourselves. And therefore, a ruchli is dikke thing, a spiritual concept, cannot be affected by external stimuli. A spiritual being cannot be affected by external stimuli, and therefore it is impervious to tsoros. It's not affected by suffering. Only the physical part of us are affected by suffering. And oneg, pleasure, joy, in the sense of oneg, is the absence of tsoros, is the absence of suffering. But for suffering, include in the word, the words tsoros, sarus, narrowness, limitation, boundaries. That's where all the tsoros come from. They all come from our own limitations and from other people's limitations. That's where all the tsoros come from. But the moment we're able to release ourselves from that, things change a great deal. I was talking to somebody the other evening about the difficulty of being objective. How difficult it is, particularly in positions of responsibility, to take decisions which are really emes. You're not affected by anything else. And he answered me, and he's a person who knows because he's a person who's achieved it. He said it's only difficult in the beginning. It's difficult until you have decided absolutely that you're not interested in the extremities. You're not interested in what they think of you, either side. All you want to be sure of is that you can stand by your decision, that you satisfy that what you did was right. That's all you need. And the rest of it is like water off a duck's back. What they say about you on this side or on that side doesn't make any difference. Once you've made that decision within yourself that you really couldn't care tuppence about what they say about you, then it becomes easy to be honest. It's only difficult as long as you're worried about it. And once you're over that, you're over it. That's again the middle of the MS and the Yashrus. Getting to the point where one isn't affected by others. One's decisions and one's attitudes, one's directions are things that one has worked out oneself. And how difficult that is to get to that point. It's true, he said it's only difficult in the beginning, that's right. But how difficult it is in the beginning. How hard it is. Why? Because what's your frame of reference? You start analyzing, should I or shouldn't I? What is influencing you? You can't work in a vacuum. So I don't care what they say on my left, and I don't care what they say on my right. So what do I care about? Two very fascinating midrashim about Yaakov. The one in the beginning of Vayeshev, which Rashi in fact brings, B'sho she'atzadikim mevakshim leshev b'shalva bo'ilam hazeh. When tzaddikim seek to live in peace, in shalva, what's the good word for shalva? Tranquility. In this world, hasoton bo mekatreg. Then the sotan comes and makes mischief. Yaakov was just, he was looking for an opportunity to settle down and live quietly, and that was the point at which he lost Yosef. Omar, he says, lo dayin shu mesukun lehem lo ilam habo. It's not enough that they've got ilam habo, lo shem bevakshim leshev b'shalva bo ilam hazeh. They seek still to have tranquility in this world. Is that not enough for them what they've got in Olam Haba? Oscar tells it off. What does it bother them? So let the tzaddik have a bit of tranquility. What's he going to do with his tranquility? Is he going to sit on the beach? No. Is he going to read the newspaper? No. Is he going to watch the television? No. What's he going to do with his tranquility? He'll sit and he'll learn and he'll teach and he'll make a yeshiva and he'll spread Torah. What's he going to do? So what does it bother the Ribbono Shel'Olam that the tzaddik has a little bit of tranquility? But the key to this medrash is not in the word tranquility, the key is mevakshim. They seek tranquility. That's where the fault is. But Tel Zerov brings a second medrash. Further on in Vayeshiv and Parsha Pevov. And it says that Yosef's going down to Egypt and Yaakov's following is Moshal Laporosha Yomoshchin Oisel Makulin. This can be compared to a cow that they were schlepping off to the abattoirs. If you've ever seen cows on their way to the abattoirs, they're not very enthusiastic about the trip. They seem to sense that it's not in their best interests. The Loy Oiselim Sheches, this particular cow wouldn't move. They couldn't get it to budge. Me'osullah, what did they do? Moshchu es beno lefoneha. They took that cow's calf and they put it in front of her and they schlepped the calf off to the abattoirs. Ma'aleches achorov al korcho shaloi b'tevoso. And the cow followed the calf by force, although it wasn't in her interest. Normally the instincts of an animal lead the animal to what's in its interest. An animal has an instinctive ability to look after itself. But this mashal the Medrash brings, here we have a case of a cow that follows its calf to its own destruction. So Yaakov Avinu should have had to go down to Mitzrayim bound in chains and in heavy garments that he was schlepped, ropes and chains. This is my firstborn son. Am I going to allow him to go down to Egypt in that kind of disgrace with chains around him? I'll take his son down first, and he'll come down afterwards. By force and not in his interest. It wasn't any good that he had to go down. Tells the Rav, his usual brilliance and depth ties these two medrashim together. It says, the first medrash said, that why was Yosef taken down to Egypt? Because Yaakov was seeking tranquility. And what's the terrible Avera? We don't know yet. But he was seeking tranquility, and the Satan gets up to mischief and takes Yosef down. We also know that there's such a principle as Mido Keneged Mido, your old friend Joe, that the Ribbono Shel Olam does measure for measure, which means that by analyzing the punishment, you can understand the crime. So what was the punishment? Yosef's going down to Egypt. What's that got to do with the crime? So Tzolzorov brings the second medrash. What does the second medrash say? Yaakov should have gone down to Mitzrayim in chains and ropes. Why should he? Because he shouldn't have gone voluntarily. He's living in Eretz Yisrael. What does he have to go to Mitzrayim for? Because God said in a prophecy that he'll have to go to Mitzrayim one day, then get God schlep him there. But to voluntarily go, no. He would still be able to eat in Mitzrayim. He had a son who was in he was still able to eat in Canaan. He had a son who was in Mitzrayim, who was the king. Yosef could send him up whatever food he needed. There was no real need for Yaakov to go down to Mitzrayim. Why did he do it? Says the Medrash, because Yosef was there. That doesn't mean that was the only reason he went. Of course Yaakov calculated it and worked out that it was the right thing to do. But Chazal or Megale to us, Chazal reveal that the Ribbono Shel Olam, who is able to see deep into the hearts of every man, noted that were it not for the fact that Yosef was in Mitzrayim, Yaakov wouldn't have gone, unless he was forced. Were it not for the fact that Yosef was in Mitzrayim, he wouldn't have willingly gone. He wouldn't have gone with a glad heart, by any means. He would have stayed in Eretz Canaan. Therefore, says the Telzerov, what it was, Yaakov's weakness for parental attachment made it necessary for Yosef to be taken there as the means to get Yaakov there. Imagine for a moment that Yaakov didn't have that weakness, that he wasn't attached to his child, that it didn't mean that much to him. It wouldn't have helped with Yosef being down there. It wouldn't have worked like the Porah. But in a sense, this is a horrible medrash, comparing Yaakov's going down to Mitzrayim to the instinctive following of a cow to a calf. It diminishes the whole action. We would like to see it elevated as an act of great self-sacrifice, reasoned out as being in the interests of Klal Yisrael. No, says the medrash, it was just an instinctive act of a father following his long-lost child. That's all it was. And he's criticized for that in the medrash. On the level, whatever level we can understand, we can't understand it, we would never have been able to perceive it. But the Medrash perceives a touch of instinct in Yaakov's going to Mitzrayim. And we've talked so often about how an action performed instinctively is not nearly as great as an action performed against one's instincts. If my instincts tell me to do something and I do it, it's nitkin grace a mensch. One doesn't have to be a god or be Israel to follow your instincts. A puppy also knows how to do it, and so does a mouse. To go against your instincts. When your instincts and your impulses tell you to do something, and your mind tells you no, it's not right, it's not moral, it's not ethical. For that you need a gadlus. Here to take Yaakov's leaving of Eretz Canaan and going to Mitzrayim, the beginning of the whole development of our history, and so you know what it was? Like a cow following a calf. People have done this in history as well. They've tried to show that great events in history took place as a result of very unimportant happenings. Whereas because Napoleon got out of bed on the wrong foot one day, was in a bad mood, he decided such and such, which affected such and such, and they trace all along history to the fact that somebody 300 years ago had a cold one morning. And there might be some truth in that. That a lot of what has happened has been because of unimportant impulses and emotions and feelings of people. And here the Midrash is doing the same. Why did Yaakov go to Mitzrayim? Because he had a son there. And he couldn't be parted from his son any longer. He needed to go. Says the Telzer Rov, that was a weakness. Why? The attachment that a cow has to a calf, that's natural. And a human parent also has that to a human child. But we need to be able to act independent of our natures. That doesn't mean we always go against our instincts, but it means our instincts are irrelevant in our decisions. What we instinctively feel and impulsively would do are irrelevant in the decision that we finally make. And here we see in Yaakov a touch still at that stage in his life of being willing to follow his nature. His natural impulse still played a minute, it was infinitesimal. Without the Medrash we would never have picked it up. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam could perceive such a thing. But the Ribbono Shel Olam perceives that there's still an infinitesimal proportion of natural instinct in Yaakov's decision making process. Says the Telzer Rov, that's Bikesh Leishev B'Shalva. Why do you want tranquility? There's nothing wrong in enjoying tranquility, but seeking tranquility. A body enjoys tranquility, not the mind. The mind thrives in turmoil. The soul thrives in turmoil. It's only the body that enjoys a quiet holiday somewhere out of the way. It's not good for the mind. It takes a long time to get back into things after the holiday. And therefore the search for tranquility is indicative of the fact that nature still plays a part in one's value system. On a tiny, tiny little level, but it's there. Tzadikim mevakshim leishev b'shalva, they still go seeking after shalva. No, that's no good for them. And therefore, Yosef is taken away. If that's the case, Yaakov, if you still allow a little place for your natural pleasures and for the natural enjoyments of life, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, I know how to get you to Mitzrayim now. It's been worrying me all the time, says the Ribbono Shel Olam Kebiyochel. How am I going to get you to Mitzrayim? To take you down in ropes and chains, which is the only way I thought you would go. I can't do that to you. But now I've found the solution. I'll take your son, I'll kidnap him, and I'll send him down to Mitzrayim before you. You'll follow. You'll follow willingly, quietly, like the cow follows the calf. Because there's still a part in you which is governed by nature. And that's the Midah Keneged Midah, says the Telzer Rov. So is shalva a value, isn't it? Is oineg a value, isn't it? Is enjoyment, we see on Shabbos, we see it's oineg, and it's the ultimate of ruchnius, of spirituality in Kedusha. And yet if a tzaddik seeks shalva, he's criticized for it. The answer is to seek tranquility means that you regard tranquility as something objective and attainable. Tranquility is neither objective nor is it attainable. For tranquility means the absence of tzoras. And tzoras can only be displaced. You can't run away from them, and you can't run to tranquility. It's not a lateral thing with tzoras on the one extreme and tranquility on the other extreme. And just as I can become more frum by taking a step to the right, so I think that by taking a step towards tranquility I get a little bit closer. It doesn't work like that. Sorrows are a state of mind, and tranquility is a state of mind. And tranquility is the state of mind that exists when I am impervious to tzoros. I can't remove the tzoros. They are there. I'm a human being, surrounded by human beings whom I love. They're going to die. I'm going to die. How can I protect myself from tzoros? I can't remove the tzoros. All I can do is remove the effect the tzoros has on me. That I can do. The tzoros are going to take place, but they're not going to affect my neshama. I'm going to carry on the same. Then you've got tranquility. But you can't run after it. You can't seek it. When you run after tranquility, it's like COVID. The more you run after it, the more it runs away. Tranquility comes when it's displaced, when tzoros are displaced. And tzoros are displaced by kedusha, by emes, and by yashrus. When a person finds himself equidistant from both extremes and is able to maintain that position unaffected by extremities, when he finds himself unaffected by polarization, when he finds that he's governed only by emes, he's governed by truth and by yashrus, and that's all that matters. And he finds all of a sudden he becomes less affected by the things around him. He becomes less moody. He becomes less volatile in his moods. And he becomes more insulated from the tzoros of the society in which he lives. He's able to continue. One of the pathetic things about the society in which we live is really pathetic, one can cry when one looks at the efforts people put in to trying to escape from their tzoros, thinking it's possible, and the ruthlessness of those marketers who thrive on that weakness of people and try and persuade them that it's possible. Whether they're marketing holiday resorts, or they're marketing magic pills and tranquilizers, or they're marketing you're not going to find tranquility. There's just no change at all. If it bothers you, if the turmoil around you bothers you, not in an intellectual sense or in a moral sense, but it bothers you emotionally, it disturbs your moods, then by running somewhere else you're not going to find tranquility. And by escaping into a video, into a movie, or going on holiday, you're not going to find tranquility. That's simply a temporary removal of the cause of the temporary blinding oneself to the cause of the chaos. Tranquility is going to be found in Kedusha and in Emes. That's why people often laugh when I say, when somebody comes and discusses a problem, very often, not always, but very often I say to them, you know, you'll develop a bit further in your learning and the problem will disappear. Because what one tries to achieve in one's learning is the Midah HaEmes. The purpose of learning is to be able to develop the ability to analyze an issue Alpi Torah and Alpi Emes without in any way being influenced by one's own preconceived ideas or by whatever else is being said at the moment. That's the ultimate. That's what distinguishes a Lamdan from an amateur. A Lamdan can take a piece of Gemara or a Chazal and analyze it for what it is, with the emes of what it is, unaffected by what other people are saying around him. And Talmid Chochem is able, furthermore, to govern his life by those conclusions which he reaches. That comes straight from the Torah, not from his society and not from his environment. The tranquility which Yaakov was seeking was not to be found in the places he was seeking it and in the way he was seeking it. It had to be found in where he ultimately reached, in his perfection of the Midah HaEmes. The moment one discovers that middle line, which always remains equidistant from both extremes, which never tilts one iota to the left or to the right, the moment a person is able to elevate himself to a plane of Kedusha, he carries on relating to the whole world exactly as he related before. There's no change externally in what he does. Everything he does is the same, except it's from the aspect and from the vantage point of Kedusha, of a separateness. I'm here to influence the world, not to be influenced by the world. All of a sudden the tranquility starts coming. Not because the cause is removed, not because there's no more rioting, and because the stock market isn't going down still, and because the gold price isn't collapsing or going up or whatever it's doing. Not because of that. Just because it doesn't affect my state of mind anymore. That's all. I know how to respond. I know how to act. I know how to retain that straightness. The whole going straight means not being deflected. And being affected means being deflected. The middle of emes is the middle of yeshurun, the middle of straightness, which is the middle of not being able to be deflected by either extreme. No matter how great the turmoil, I am able to go straight. I've often said that a great ship is not a ship that knows how to always steer through calm waters. You take a ship, you say, this is a wonderful ship. Whenever I've been on it, it's been, you can hardly feel you moving. It's the most wonderful ship. And I say, that's very interesting. Where have you been on it? How many times have you been? Oh, I go on it every year, the person tells me. Many times. And there's never been a seasickness, of course not, but you haven't even felt movement. So where do you go on the ship every so often? It's on the Zoo Lake. It's not a great ship. A person says he's been on a ship and it's gone through the wild waves of the Pacific and it's gone round the Straits of Magellan and it's been round the Cape of Good Hope. Beautiful. Don't feel a thing. That's a great ship. To be able to remain straight when the extremities are violent, that's when one has a godless. To be able to retain the emeskite, the truth, when the extremities of sheker are powerful, that's when there's godless. And towards that we have to strive. And that should be our goal.